After now retired assistant Penn State football coach Jerry Sandusky was arrested on multiple charges of child sex abuse, allegedly involving children he often invited to his workplace and his home, he didn't fall from grace alone. University trustees fired football coach Joe Paterno in November, saying his response to a 2001 report from a team assistant about seeing Sandusky in a shower with a boy showed a lack of leadership. Paterno, who said he wished he had done more, died of cancer in January. That's just a little bit of the fallout we're going to talk about today on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Welcome. Like most child sex abuse cases, the allegations leave many of us wondering, what would I have done? What could I have done? What should I have done? Coming up later, we'll hear from an expert who counsels victims of child sex abuse and who's also a representative of a survivors group who is attending the trial, which is expected to wrap up tomorrow in Pennsylvania. Joining us now to go over the legal points is Mark Spindelman, a law professor at the OSU Moritz College of Law, where he teaches courses on family law, public health ethics, health law, and sexual violence. Mark is also a board member of Male Survivor, an organization committed to preventing, healing, and eliminating all forms of sexual victimization of boys and men through treatment, research, education, advocacy, and activism. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thanks for having me on.
So in the grand scheme of things, is this a typical trial when it comes to these sorts of allegations?
No, this is not a typical trial, sort of in many, many respects. So it's not typical in the sense of the media attention that the case is getting. And it's also not typical in terms of the kind of evidence that has been being brought forth by the prosecution in the prosecution of Jerry Sandusky.
How so?
So there are a couple of different ways. So here, first of all, we have sort of a significant number of victims who've been brave enough to come forward to tell their stories. And the stories that they're telling over and over again bear remarkable similarities. In addition to that, there are also multiple witnesses who are not directly parties in the sense that they are claiming that they were themselves injured, but who say that they saw what happened to the boys who were in fact and are in fact claiming that they were harmed by Jerry Sandusky. So it's both the number of the victims, the similarity of their stories, and then this third party testimony that that distinguishes the case, in addition to sort of how high profile it is.
So given that, yet Jerry Sandusky says he's not guilty.
Yeah.
So he, in the face of all of that, he goes forward with this pretty sensational trial now in Pennsylvania. What about the sensationalism of it? Can you get a fair trial these days in light of all of that?
Well, I mean, here we have the system working in a particular way to make sure that the jurors are not biased in terms of their ability to consider the evidence fairly and fully without prejudice on either side. And you have a very experienced trial judge who is running the trial. And from all accounts and sort of all sorts of efforts to make sure that the prosecution doesn't have sort of an unfair upper hand. So from all accounts that we can see, it looks like the trial itself is fair.
If you have a question or comment for my guest, Mark Spindelman, he is a professor of law at the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University. Give us a call. We're talking about the Jerry Sandusky trial. It continues today, may wrap up tomorrow. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. It busted out sometime last fall when the first allegations came to light. Then there was the grand jury investigation. Yeah. How do those things work, and how did it come to what it did? How did they get to where they get?
Yeah, so there are investigations, there are grand jury proceedings, and then ultimately a decision whether to go ahead with a prosecution and charging an individual with the crimes, which is what happened here. Then sort of now we see the trial unfolding in front of us since Sandusky decided to plead not guilty and to take it to trial.
What does it mean to other people out there who are victims of abuse in similar ways? What should they be looking for, and can they draw any conclusions for themselves when they're watching a trial like this or following it, I should say?
Yeah, sort of. In a sense, on the more hopeful side, I think that the trial is a demonstration that the legal system is, in fact, open to the claims that male victims, like female victims, have to bring to it and before it, which is important for people to understand. hand. I think it's also important for people to understand, though, that because this trial is a little bit unusual, it's possible to come away with the impression that these cases are easy to prosecute with this kind of overwhelming evidence in case after case after case. Part of the reason why I was emphasizing both the number of victims, the similarity of their stories, as well as the third-party witnesses that the case involves, is to underscore that this is different than a kind of classic in a same-sex case involving two men or a boy and a man, a he said case. This is not that kind of setup in terms of sort of the structure of the arguments and the presentation of the facts. So in that sense, it looks different than some other cases or than the sort of ordinary case, which might just involve a single victim bringing suit against someone claiming that they're claiming perpetrated violence against them. In that sense, it's sort of not that kind of dyadic model. It's a different kind of situation here.
And a lot of that has everything to do with the fact of who Jerry Sandusky is and what he did and who he worked for. I mean, if somebody brings these kinds of allegations against an ordinary, everyday person, it never makes it to the paper. It never makes the explosive headlines that it does. All the other potential victims out there would never know.
Yeah, I mean, remember in this case, there were charges that had accusations that had been leveled earlier on, and at least in one of the cases, there was some kind of investigation that was ultimately dropped, and so it looks like in this particular case, what might have happened was that somehow in virtue of who Jerry Sandusky was in the world in terms of the position that he held, there was some kind of structural imbalance of power. And it takes in this kind of case, perhaps, this many accusations with this many stories and this kind of objective third-party testimony to really level the inequalities that might otherwise have existed.
What about the idea the judge required that the alleged victims use their real names when they gave testimony?
Yeah, there was real concern about that in many quarters, including in quarters of folks who sort of are representing survivors of sexual abuse, in part because there was real fear that the victims would sort of have their names released. But the judge in that sense, it looked like there was a real effort on the part of the judge to bend over backwards to make sure that the prosecution didn't have any kind of there was no appearance that the prosecution was being given any sort of unfair advantage in the trial proceedings. So far, it looks like the media have done a remarkable job of respecting the privacy of the boys and now men who are bringing the complaints and who are testifying, so that even though they had to testify in court, their names have not been released broadly in the media.
Yesterday, there were witnesses for the defense testifying on the behalf of Jerry Sandusky and his reputation and his personality and who he is, his wife among them. Is that unusual? Yeah.
No. I don't think it's unusual to have character evidence being presented to give the jurors a sense that the accused is not the kind of person who would do this sort of thing, that speak to character in a positive way, particularly after all of the evidence that's been brought forward by the prosecution to suggest that in terms of character, this is Sandusky's character is not certainly what his witnesses are saying that it is.
What about the issue of the histrionic psychological problems?
So I'll leave it to Dr. Fradkin, one of your other guests today, to talk a little bit about the details of that, if it's appropriate. But in terms of what function it serves in the legal proceedings, the idea is that that the behavior, in particular, I guess, of writing these love letters, is somehow excusable or explicable in terms of this disorder. So somehow they didn't really mean to reflect an underlying relationship. This was a product of some kind of diseased mind.
Is the histrionic disorder been brought up before, to your knowledge, or at least the idea of that, if not the literal reference to it?
I'm sure that what's certainly the case is that there are many sorts of mental disorders that are brought into criminal proceedings as ways of explaining or excusing or in some instances even justifying the behavior of criminal defendants. One of the most famous, Dr. Fradkin reminded me of this before, was the famous Twinkie defense in the case involving Harvey Milk, where the idea was that Dan White, who had was accused of killing Harvey Milk, said, you know, sort of the defense was that sort of too many Twinkies, right, as the explanation for what happened.
Of course, Harvey Milk from San Francisco, who was assassinated in several years ago. The Twinkie defense. That I was curious about Jerry Sandusky's wife as well, testifying that she didn't see anything inappropriate between him and the eight accusers who offered the graphic testimony. And that the Sandusky home was a welcoming place for them. Was that she was on the stand for about an hour? Again, is that very typical for a wife in those kinds of, or a spouse, I should say?
It's not surprising. I mean, part of you know, when one reads some of the legal materials, or if someone had occasion to listen to all the testimony, there's this testimony, among other things, saying that one of the boys was in the basement screaming for help. It's a really, really amazingly just a horrific description of what happened. And his wife was in the house, according to the testimony. And there was apparently a little bit of back and forth asking, you know, sort of if she had any hearing problems. And her testimony was, you know, if there had been any screams, she would have heard. And at this point, it's really there's a kind of sharp conflict as between the two. I mean, one can't hear the testimony that this boy was screaming for her help or for help in the house, knowing that she was there and without being very moved by it. And on the other side, it's hard to sort of reconcile her testimony that she didn't hear anything, and if there'd been any screaming coming from the basement, she would have heard it. There's just a sharp conflict of testimony. The jury's going to have to make a determination about who's more believable under the circumstances. The witness who's saying that he was abused and screamed for help, or Jerry Sandusky's wife.
There's another conflict in the testimony with the witness who said that he was being abused by Jerry Sandusky in a hotel room when they were out of town together. She literally walked in on them and saw what was happening. And her side of the story is, no, he was arguing with him because he had bought a $50 ticket to go to an event and the kid didn't want to go.
Yeah.
Just that kind of complete. There's a he said, she said.
Right. So he said, she said, can come up in this kind of trial. Although here the he said, she said is not between the person who is claiming that they were abused by the other person. The she said in this case is the wife of the accused, whose denial of the accusations are doing the work of, in a sense, vindicating or exonerating or exculpating Jerry Sandusky.
My guest is Mark Spindelman, law professor at OSU Moritz College of Law and a board member of Male Survivor. When we return, we'll be hearing from Christopher Anderson. He's executive director of Male Survivor, and he has been in the courtroom the past couple weeks during the Jerry Sandusky trial. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
A showdown between the Attorney General and Congress over Fast and Furious, the president swings first on immigration as both he and Romney reach out to Latino voters, and New York's Charlie Rangel faces the fight of his political life. I'm Neil Conan. Ken Rudin, the political junkie, joins us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. Be sure to visit WOSU.org/allsides. There you can watch the show live weekdays from 10 until noon. Also be sure to explore the All Sides archive. It includes audio and video of every show. That's WOSU.org/allsides. 84 degrees with sunshine in downtown Columbus. Sunny skies today. Another hot day with a high of 93. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 71. More sunshine and a high in the 90s on Thursday. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Retired Penn State assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky is charged with 51 counts of child sex abuse involving 10 alleged victims over a 15-year span dating back to the mid-1990s. The charges include 11 counts of involuntary deviant sexual intercourse, 9 counts of indecent assault, 9 counts of unlawful contact with a minor, 10 counts of corruption of minors, 10 counts of endangering a child's welfare, 1 count of aggravated indecent assault, and 1 count of attempted indecent assault. Trial is expected to wrap up tomorrow, earlier than expected, after a raft of testimony this week from character witnesses for Jerry Sandusky. Joining us from Pennsylvania, where he has been attending the trial, is Christopher Anderson. He's executive director of Male Survivor, an organization committed to preventing, healing, and eliminating all forms of sexual victimization of boys and men through treatment, research, education, advocacy, and activism. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is not typical for you to attend a trial like this.
No, and I think that this is a very atypical trial for our culture, and I'm very hopeful that this represents a shift within the culture of our ability to be able to start talking about these issues and to support survivors being able to come forward and bring charges against their abusers.
Mark Spindleman and I were talking about that earlier. Because it's so unusual, how can it be helpful when you talk about someone else's experience and the more typical experience?
Well, one thing to stress is that the experience of abuse itself is not unusual. It is shockingly common within our society, and one of the great lessons that I believe we are finally learning because of this trial is just how widespread abuse is. Even in addition to what's happened at Penn State, over just since January of this year, we have heard of stories breaking in schools and institutions all over the country that highlight just how widespread an epidemic sexual abuse is within the culture.
You're saying since this broke?
I believe that the trial coming to light and the Sandusky story happening has helped a lot of people be able to come forward, and it's allowed the media, I think, to also be able to speak more openly about stories of this nature. This has really truly been a focusing moment for our culture to be able to allow us to talk more about these issues.
Mark Spindleman?
Yeah, I think Chris is exactly right here. There's an important way in which it's been hard in many respects for the legal system, although we've come and made great headway in understanding sexual violence that men perpetrate against girls and women. The kinds of sexual injuries that boys and men suffer have in many ways remained foreign to the legal system and its apparatus for apprehending and punishing and including convicting perpetrators of male-male abuse. So part of what I think Chris is right to point out here is that this is one of the first instances sort of in recent memory, although there have been a number of cases involving church sex abuse, sort of that comes sort of out of the usual context that we've now come to understand this sort of sexual violence. And part of what it's doing, given how high profile the defendant in the case is and the context of it being within the context of Penn State's football program, really is helping folks in part through the courage of the boys, now men, who are claiming that they were injured by Sandusky to really reshape paradigms for the legal system to think about or be able to apprehend this form and this kind of sexual injury.
Chris, what is it like in the courtroom? What is the atmosphere there? How crowded is it? How many people are there? What's happening?
Well, the courtroom is packed to the gills, and there is an overflow room for extra media members. Every day of the trial that I've been here, by the time that the trial actually gets underway, the room has been filled to capacity. The atmosphere has been, by and large, very respectful, and a lot of the conversations that I've been having with spectators have been very open. I've been a little surprised. I was expecting to see more people from the community coming out in disbelief or trying to say that this couldn't have happened. And what I've actually been finding in speaking with media and speaking with other spectators, there's a real openness and an understanding that there's something bad that really happened here. And a lot of people in the Penn State community and in the Center County community really feel strongly that this is a moment for the community as a whole to learn about how they can do a better job protecting children within the community. And that's been a really wonderful thing to see in the courtroom.
Mark Spindleman, to what extent does the jury have to be protected from that or shielded or insulated from that atmosphere to do their job?
Well, it's important for the jury to remain impartial throughout the deliberations on both sides. So, and at the same time, the members of the jury are members of the community, and part of the reality of what has happened in that community. So, I think as much as possible, the judge will, certainly has tried to preserve the integrity of the jury and their deliberations and their proceedings.
Yes, Christopher?
I was just going to say, and I could touch on what Mark was just speaking about. Mm-hmm. I've been very impressed with the way Judge Wheeland has been handling what could have been obviously a media circus and a very sensational moment. His instructions to the jury, he's been reminding them very calmly and very and consistently of their duty to remain impartial. He's also announced that he's going to be sequestering the jury for deliberations, which I thought was a very good sign to try and help ensure that they're going to be able to discuss and deliberate all of these charges without the outside distractions of what's, obviously a situation that's garnered a lot of attention from all around the country.
You don't go to these kinds of trials typically, if ever. Why this? I know this one is super famous, but in terms of what you try to strive for, in terms of reforms and that sort of thing, what do you achieve by being there?
The biggest thing that Male Survivor is hoping to accomplish by having a presence here is to show our support for the brave young men who have come out of the shadows and the silence to take a stand against their abuser. The other opportunities that this trial presents for us are the ability to speak to the public about these issues, to let people know that healing is possible for every single survivor, that there are organizations like Male Survivor and other community organizations that are working diligently to bring more support to all survivors of sexual abuse. And with regards to statutory reform and legal matters, mm-hmm. This presents a very important moment for us to be able to speak to the legal system and to lawmakers and educate them on issues as, for instance, why restrictive statute of limitations are so damaging to the society, because we know it takes so long for the majority of sexual abuse survivors to be able to come forward and speak their truth, even within a healing context. For these young men to have been able to come forward and bring these charges publicly and openly, it's truly remarkable and heroic and extraordinarily uncommon. And that's one of the things that we are also hoping to try to highlight to the public and to lawmakers, that there are statutory reforms that we need to put into place that reflect the true experience of survivors themselves.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. The Jerry Sandusky trial continues today, probably wraps up tomorrow. If you have questions or comments for our guests, Mark Spindleman, law professor at the OSU Moritz College of Law and also a board member of Male Survivor, and Chris Anderson, he's talking to us from Pennsylvania. He's the executive director of Male Survivor. I wanted to introduce now Dr. Howard Fradkin. He is a psychologist at Affirmations in Columbus and the co-chairperson of the Male Survivor Weekends of Recovery. He's also a founding board member of Male Survivor. His book, Joining Forces, Empowering Male Survivors to Thrive, will be released in November. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Howard Fradkin.
Thank you, Ann. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to ask you, if we have a chicken or egg situation here when it comes to these young men, because they are very young. These are not, guys in their 40s or 50s who have done some kind of full circle in their life. These are still really, in many ways, psychologically young, children in a way. They're 18, 19. They're not that old. Is that a sign of a larger change in our society, perhaps, where they're starting to feel comfortable, they understand more, they know more than maybe people did 20, 30, 40 years ago?
I think that's a hopeful sign that they have found the courage to be able to come forward. As Chris was saying, it's unusual. Typically, the folks that we deal with, the male survivor, are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s even. Mm-hmm. It's taken that long for them to be able to get to a place where they're willing to address these issues. It's important to just understand that the shame that a survivor feels after such an assault on their bodies and on their spirits and their souls is profound, and it takes a very long time. So that these men have been able to come forward at this time is remarkable and shows great courage on their part.
The idea that they're accused of doing this for money, not unusual.
I don't know whether it's unusual. The problem with it is that it's absurd that they would take such a humongous risk to bring these kinds of charges forward in terms of having to risk that people will know them. And we already know that some of them were bullied after the charges were first brought up. I mean, this is not something somebody does lightly. And for money, it doesn't make sense. I mean, there's way too much shame involved to be doing this simply for money. That doesn't make psychological sense to me.
Christopher Anderson?
And if I may, one of the other things that I've said, and as I am myself also a survivor of sexual abuse, I should have stated that earlier, I can say as a survivor, there is one thing that survivors want. We want to heal. There is no amount of money in the world that can compensate us for the things that were taken away from us by our abusers and the damage that has been done to us.
And so that sort of assertion, it's probably pretty typical in a courtroom. You hear it all the time. You're doing this for money, whether it's about sex abuse or not. It's always about money. That's something most likely that they've been prepared for, hopefully.
One would expect that they would have been prepared for various sorts of ways in which the defense attorney would try to discredit them, right? So this is a not entirely surprising defense maneuver. Whether it's true is a question that the defense will be put to eventually against the kinds of psychological realities that Dr. Fradkin was just describing, right? Sort of the defense may say it's so, but sort of people on the jury are going to have to figure out whether it seems credible that these people who are clearly in instances struggling to tell their story on the stand, which is incredibly understandable under the circumstances, whether they seem like people who are in this for money.
Christopher Anderson, you told me that this is the first time you've ever attended a trial like this, a criminal trial like this. Is that because there just aren't that many out there that get to this point and have this sort of magnitude?
Yes, that's very true. There have been trials and cases against, for instance, members of the clergy in the past, but many of those cases did not receive the kind of attention that this case has received. And I don't want to make it sound like male survivors are only interested in attending big, high-profile cases, but we are a growing organization, and it's only very recently that we've ourselves begun to have the resources to be able to show up and attend trials like this, to be able to support and have a presence in the community speaking on these issues.
Dr. Fradkin, since this busted loose last fall, what's been the reaction from the people you treat? Is this something you're talking about actively with people in your different therapy groups?
I've talked about it with just about every single male and female survivor that I work with. It's been profoundly disturbing for many of them. It triggers all the same kinds of feelings and memories that they have. Some of them have come up with new memories. A lot of times it's just immensely disturbing to hear both the testimony from these men as well as to hear what Jerry Sandusky has said, what people are saying about him, the kinds of reactions from Penn State, hearing things like that the president said it would be humane to protect Jerry Sandusky and not report him. It's like, well, what about protecting the humanity of these victims? You know, it outrages a lot of survivors.
The issue of the showering with the boys, as most people that you talk to on the street, when you mentioned that when the story came out and those visuals became commonplace, said, that's ridiculous. Why would a grown man be showering with a 10-year-old boy or a 12-year-old boy or anything like that? And yet there was another coach that came on the stand this week, or I think it was this week, a character witness for Jerry Sandusky saying, yeah, we did that. We all did it. How can we be living in two such different realities where so many people think that's appalling and another group say, well, it's perfectly normal?
Well, I think it's important that we be clear that, at least from the testimony of these men, it wasn't simply that they were in the same shower at the same time. Jerry Sandusky is allegedly sexually assaulting them in a shower. That's very different. Nobody's got on the stand and said, oh, yes, we regularly sexually assault boys in a shower. I mean, they're talking about in a YMCA where all sorts of different people of all different ages may be in the shower room at the same time. That's not the same thing as Jerry Sandusky taking these men into the shower himself and then seducing them by playing with them, making it into a game, so to speak. I mean, it's a very different dynamic.
Christopher Anderson, what's coming up later on, possibly a testimony by Jerry Sandusky himself. What are your expectations of something like that? Have you ever heard anything like that before?
We know that Jerry Sandusky has nothing to lose in trying this case forward to the fullest extent that he can and mounting as strong a defense as he can. It's an open question on everybody's mind whether the strongest defense he could make would be to take the stand himself. And we don't know yet whether he's going to by the end of today or not. It seems like it's a coin flip to everybody I talk to. I have to say my reaction, having been in the courtroom and listened to both the prosecution last week and now the majority of what the defense has presented this week, it seems to me as though there's not that much that Sandusky himself could bring to light on his own that would seem to merit his taking the stand, but that's just my personal opinion.
And yet, Mark Spindelman?
So I would just add to that that it's not just, as Chris correctly points out, what there is that Sandusky has to gain, but there's also quite significantly what he potentially has to lose. I mean, we know from the media interview that he previously gave that he may not be the best witness on the stand to begin with. And then there are all sorts of ways in which he may open himself up by being on the stand to sorts of cross and interrogation, cross-examination by the prosecutor that would be incredibly powerful and incredibly damning and could, in fact, be an occasion on which he would, with the prosecutor's help, seal his own coffin in relation to the charges.
Chris Anderson, before we let you go, I wanted to ask you about the issue of using the alleged victims having their names used in court and identifying themselves in court. Now, the media has not done that. But what is your sense about that and how they've handled that?
It just adds to the heroic way in which I see them. At some point, this is all public record, but I'm very happy that the media has not, as of yet, in any way divulged or leaked any personal information about these survivors. Because it's a very important thing to point out, as Dr. Fragkin mentioned earlier, this is a small community, and we already know that there's been pressure placed on some of these victims by members of the community. To know going into this that their identities were not going to be shielded was a shock and a surprise, I think, to some of them as the trial was coming up, and that none of them decided to withdraw from testifying just speaks to their immense courage again.
Well, Christopher Anderson, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you so much for having me in. I appreciate it.
Christopher Anderson, he's executive director of Male Survivor. When we return, we'll continue our conversation. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins with a discussion, is there a shortage of lifeguards for public pools? Also, training lifeguards. And also next hour, local Mount Everest climber almost reached the top. Metro Parks Director John O'Mara joins the show. That's All Sides with Ann Fisher from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the state auto insurance companies providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com.
And tonight on WOSU-TV, NOVA follows the development of the telescope over several centuries. The program also looks at recent missions, the voyage of a spacecraft to Saturn, a telescope search for planets beyond our solar system, and the examination of the Milky Way, which is so large it would take 100,000 years traveling at the speed of light to cross from one edge to the other. Watch NOVA Hunting the Edge of Space tonight at 9 on WOSU-TV. And it's 85 degrees in downtown Columbus, a hot day today, sunshine and a high in the mid-90s. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 71, more sunshine and a high of 91 on Thursday. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Today on All Sides, we're talking about the trial of retired Penn State assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky. He's been charged with 51 counts of child sex abuse involving 10 alleged victims over a 15-year span dating back to the mid-1990s. The trial is expected to wrap up tomorrow, earlier than expected, but it may not. Still with us is Mark Spendelman. He's a law professor at the OSU Moritz College of Law. Mark is a board member of Male Survivor. And joining us now is, still with us also, is psychologist Howard Fradkin, a founding board member of Male Survivor, psychologist at Affirmations in Columbus, and the co-chairperson of the Male Survivor Weekends of Recovery. We've been talking, in between the breaks about the idea of the whole showering together and horsing around thing and the distinctions that can be made between those ideas. And he has, and Jerry Sandusky has talked about that with in taped or recorded interviews on television. That's been a pretty big problem for him going into this. Mark Spindleman?
Yeah, it's been a big problem. Part of what's interesting, sort of if one takes a look at some of the cases, not necessarily only involving allegations of child sex abuse, but of same-sex male-male harassment, is this idea of male horseplay often comes up in the cases. And what goes under the heading of horseplay is often quite remarkable. And to many, including many of the people who endured the experiences of so-called horseplay, it was anything but. But as Dr. Fradkin pointed out before, I mean, part of what was being seen and being seen to be being done by these third parties was nothing like horseplay. I mean, it was a sexual assault, right? I mean, it was the acts were very serious, and the idea that sort of whatever one happens to think about sort of being in communal space and showering adults and underage children, sort of in the ways that you were describing before. Certainly, as Dr. Fradkin said, this went well beyond anything that I think anybody would reasonably describe as normal or appropriate behavior.
Dr. Fradkin, you were talking earlier about other patients of yours and people that you treat in therapy groups and that sort of thing, and their reaction to this. And you mentioned that this hasn't necessarily had a positive effect on them overall. I think some people might think that, well, you know, it's coming out and it's validating and it's affirming, you know, all the struggles they've had personally in their own lives. But that's not necessarily, it can be damaging as well.
It can be damaging, but there is that positive aspect of, while these guys have shown great courage, and it has indeed inspired many people to be able to speak their truth for the first time to people in their lives. So that's been very positive. At the same time, it's traumatizing. It's traumatizing for any of us in society, even if we've never been abused, to hear the details of this case. For those who've been abused, it can be very traumatizing. Not always, but it's very upsetting to have to re-experience what you've already been through, and to hear the excuses that perpetrators might use that are being used in this trial can be very upsetting to know that it sometimes creates doubt in somebody's mind, like, well, maybe I, you know, made this up, or maybe it wasn't as bad as I thought it was. And it just, it causes a lot of confusion and oftentimes a lot of deep pain and suffering, and more of that shame that that survivors are trying to heal from and can heal from.
Not all survivors go public with it. It's not their modus operandi. What about folks like that? Are there people that are feeling guilty, like, I wish I had the courage to do that, and what's wrong with me that I can't come out and tell people what happened to me? And
sure. I mean, this is unusual for these men to be able to be this public. I mean, that's very rare. It is more common that survivors are able to tell someone in their life, and that is indeed one of the major steps in healing, is that you have to be able to speak your truth to someone who will respect your courage and will honor you and will help you get the assistance that you need to heal and fully recover.
John in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, John.
Hi, thanks very much, Ann. So I'm a board member of SESAME, Stop Educators Sexual Abuse, Misconduct, and Exploitation. And I'm just calling in to say we're on the forefront trying to stay connected with this case. But I wanted to say, bring up the Joe Paterno real sensitive issue that people have a real hard time talking about, and like to key in on one of his last comments of his life was, he said, I should have done more. And so I would just encourage the whole listening audience to know that educator sexual misconduct is real. It's out there. It's epidemic. And we all need to do more, all of us, parents, teachers, administrators, coaches, in protecting children. And we can't be having the blind eyes or not reporting. And, you know, there are laws that we need to be aware of. Most people aren't. And so I just want to encourage the listening audience to use this opportunity to become fully educated about their responsibilities and how to respond and what to do when you might observe or see something like this of such an awkward and heinous nature. We, as Joe Paterno said, he should have done more, and all of us need to do more.
Well, John, what do you recommend? What should people do?
Well, I think education is absolutely key. I've done training for educators for their mandatory reporting. And it only takes less than a minute to do a Google search for child sexual abuse or child sexual abuse by educators. And anybody at their fingertips has a wealth of knowledge to educate themselves and what to do, especially parents. Parents need to be plugged in all the time, just not at certain times. I had six of my own children. One of my children actually was touched by a person that had a previous record. And, you know, as parents, my wife and I sensed something wasn't right on the day she returned that day from school. And, you know, we were able to be in tune enough to know that something had happened. So, you know, parents from early on have to stay plugged in with their children to know their demeanor, know their actions, know their mannerisms and all that. And educators in the classroom, they're on the forefront. They should be well-trained to recognize any kind of behaviors that are not appropriate at all and have a way to dialogue with that with their administrators in the community. And this is severely lacking. You know, we just don't know how to talk about it, because sometimes people say, I don't know what I saw. I'm not sure what I saw. And we just have to keep this dialogue going so that it's a healthy way to discuss child safety, child protection, and also how to recognize when certain adults, teachers, coaches, ministers, priests, are just not emotionally or psychologically or sexually appropriate to be around children. We just need to do a better job at that. And the community has to step up to the plate. They have to say, we're going to have these conversations and training.
John, thanks for your call.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Dr. Fradkin, I guess on another note then, what about friends and family of victims, have you had a sense about how they're reacting to this? And are you hearing from people who are saying, you know, I'm looking back over time and thinking maybe there was something up. What should I do?
I think it has increased people's awareness a lot, and that's been very helpful. So that a lot, what's increased is the ability of friends and family to be much more attuned, as John was saying, about changes, about differences, and just beginning to think about, wow, that guy that I had trouble with in a relationship, I could never figure out why we couldn't get close. And that's one of the difficulties that survivors have, is difficulties with intimacy. And that's not always the case that it's because of abuse, but sometimes it is. And a lot of times men are not able to talk about that. So partners are getting more sensitive to that and more aware of that. Parents, I think, are becoming more aware that they have to pay better attention to their kids and notice when there are changes and to be able to talk to them. I suggest to parents that they say to their kids, anytime you have a problem, anytime there's something that's uncomfortable, anytime somebody might touch you in a way that you don't like, that's uncomfortable for you, you can always come and tell us, and we will never punish you. We'll never hurt you. We want to be able to help you. And kids need to know that their parents are there for them.
And then you hear some people say, I don't want to bring that up to my kid. Why should I start scaring my kid that somebody's going to hurt them and touch them inappropriately? Why would I want to do that?
Because it's a way to protect them. Children are afraid that their parents will be upset with them. When children are abused, they tend to blame themselves. They think it's their fault. And unless they know there's somebody they can talk to get help, that they can reach out to, then they will keep it to themselves because of all that shame that they've experienced. Parents have a responsibility. The school system has a responsibility. Churches, every institution has a responsibility to make it possible for people to speak this truth.
Matt in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Yeah, I just wanted to, like, make one comment. I don't know if you guys have talked about this before, but pertaining to the Penn State, like, students that, you know, went in, like, full-scale riot because they fired, you know, Joe Paterno. And, you know, this is a guy who got fired because he failed to take action against, you know, a sexual offender or an accused sexual offender. And I just wanted to, you know what you guys thought about that. Like, it seems like the students are more concerned with football than justice.
Dr. Fredkin?
I was on Dr. Phil a while back, and the president of the student body was on, and they were, many people at Penn State were very upset about those riots. So it's true that those riots occurred, and it's also true that there was a huge group of students who were very upset with the rioters and who wanted to make sure that Penn State was known as a place that was sensitive to survivors. And I think they've taken a lot of steps in that regard to make themselves more aware. The alumni have stepped forward and given over $1 million of money to help child abuse agencies to help prevent this kind of abuse. So, yes, that happened. But I think that Penn State's going as far as they can to try to rectify those kinds of situations. And today, there's much more awareness on the part of folks. I know there are people at Penn State. I was there doing training, and some of the students even don't even want to say they go to Penn State. They're so ashamed. I mean, that's the kind of effect of this trauma. So, yes, that did happen.
As usual, maybe the squeaky wheels got a lot of the attention on that one.
Yeah.
Matt, thanks for your call. You know, we there's always, of course, been a lot of talk over the years about clergy, you know, sex abuse by child sex abuse by clergy. Nothing new. But, you know, we just heard an announcement, you know, about what the new football coach at Ohio State's going to be making. These people make a lot of money. They are incredibly powerful people. And that starts all the way. It starts at the high school level with the coaches. They don't necessarily, Lord knows, make the same kind of money, but there's just a lot of power. And I have received a few emails this morning from people about the show saying, are you going to talk about the church? Are you going to talk about the church and what they do? How much of a parallel is there, Dr. Fredkin? Is it pretty much the same thing, or are there differences?
Well, one of the differences, I think, is that the church has had a great deal, the Catholic Church especially, has had a great deal of trouble in being accountable. They have taken some action, but then they don't really follow through. I mean, it's been a major problem. I just consulted on a case where the archbishop in a particular diocese was still basically saying that the behavior of the priest was perfectly acceptable and there was nothing wrong with it after he abused a kid in the sacristy. And he said the kid still should have, that the kid was committing a sin. I was like, how could this possibly be true in 2012 with everything that the church has supposedly put in place? Penn State did eventually take appropriate action. They removed the president. They removed Joe Paterno. They've taken action. They've been accountable. And I think this case is making institutions much more aware of their institutional accountability in a way that's never happened before.
Mark, you work at a Big Ten university. What's your impression of that and the impact?
So I think that there's everything that Dr. Fradkin said is right. I do think it's interesting to notice that there is at least the following similarity. not only that these forms of abuse took place in an institutional context, but in an institutional context where, as you, Anne, were pointing out, the perpetrators or alleged perpetrators often have an extraordinary amount of power in relation to the people they're being accused of having harmed. And those power imbalances are not just sort of in the abstract. They're very concrete. They're very meaningful. Sort of can lend both to the occasion and opportunity and possibility for abuse, and also highlight and underscore the significance of the injuries.
One of the things,
go ahead,
is that kind of power generates trust. So what happens is they get all that trust not only from the victim but also from the victim's family
first,
and then they betray the trust, and that's part of the profound injury.
Dr. Howard Fradkin, thanks for joining us again. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Ann.
And also Mark Spindleman, OSU Law Professor. Mark, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, Ann.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.